Case number 15-3056 et al. United States of America versus Dwayne Brown, also known as Goon, appellant. Ms. Davis for appellant Boston. Ms. Pembrick for appellant Brown. Ms. Kate for appellant Adona. Mr. Zucker for appellant Matthews. And Mr. Ewing for the government.
Ms. Davis.
Good morning. May it please the court. We raise a single issue on appeal, and that is whether there is sufficient evidence to convict Mr. Boston on the single count of possession with intent to distribute PCP. The judge, as I'm sure the court is aware, granted MJOAs on the conspiracy count and the possession of body armor count. The jury convicted him on the single count, possession with intent to distribute, and acquitted him on all the other firearm violations. Our main argument is that mere presence or proximity to the drugs is insufficient to convict Mr. Boston. The government cited five reasons to demonstrate more than what they believe is more than mere proximity. One is that Mr. Boston was not just a casual visitor. Second, that he was engaged in PCP distribution. Third, that there was a battering ram was used, and after the officers entered, there was a smell of PCP and the toilet was running. There was physical evidence recovered, and the government names all the vials and the firearms and everything else that was found. There were guns found, and there were photos on Mr. Boston's phone. And finally, there was a fingerprint on a empty bottle that did at one point contain PCP. In regard to the first argument, we submit that even though Mr. Boston was not a casual visitor, that does not weigh in the government's favor because a number of other people were coming to that apartment and they were storing their drugs there. So just because Mr. Boston may have stayed there at times, that is not sufficient to hold him accountable for the drugs that were there. Secondly, although Mr. Boston was involved in PCP distribution, the testimony was that he distributed outside the apartment, not inside it. And also, according to this circuit's case in Dorman, doing drug business is not sufficient to hold a person accountable for drugs that are found within a premise. In regard to the smell of the PCP, there is no evidence at trial how long the smell of PCP lingers, but I think it's fair knowledge that the smell of PCP lasts for a very long time. Furthermore, there's no evidence that no one else was in the apartment prior to the police entering, because again, they did use a battering ram to enter, and so there was no evidence that someone else was, that there was no one else in there that may have left before the police entered the apartment. I think the important point here is that everything that was found as regard to evidence, none of it was in plain view, all of it was hidden. Some was found in a closet, some was found in a trash can. There was nothing out there in order for the jury to infer that Mr. Boston had to have known that these drugs were there. And finally, regarding the, as far as the guns go, again, the jury acquitted Mr. Boston of all the gun counts. And finally, the fingerprints, that's the hardest one to get around. But again, there's no evidence when the fingerprint was placed there. And I think the Lucas decision rejected the argument that that fingerprints alone constitute constructive possession of the PCP.
Can I ask you, for PCP, is there a certain amount that's considered, if it's found to be a certain amount, that's recognized to be a distribution level amount, or below a certain amount is generally assumed to be a personal use amount?
I don't know the answer to that question. I'm guessing that I think the vials that were found were, I believe, half-ounce vials.
I thought it was a one-ounce vial.
One-ounce, that was clearly considered
distribution amount. There's no dispute that one-ounce vial is a distribution amount vial.
Excuse me?
There's no dispute that one-ounce vial is a distribution amount vial.
Right. Yes. And I think what the evidence was that they were dipping cigarettes or something into the PCP vials and selling those. I don't think they were selling the vials directly.
Questions?
Any other questions? Okay, thank you.
Ms. Pembroke? As I understand the arrangement, we're going to hear from each of the defense counsel first and then consolidated response from the government.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Christine Pembroke. I represent Appellant Brown. In this matter, we have raised a challenge to the three jury instructions for the offenses upon which appellant was convicted, namely armed burglary with respect to Clifton's apartment, possession with the intent to distribute PCP, and unlawful possession of a firearm with a prior offense. The government maintains that those challenges are subject to plain error review, and I would like to begin by focusing on the harm of the error. Harm exists where there is a reasonable possibility that the outcome would have been different but for the instructional error, and that happens where the government's evidence is not overwhelming. The harm in this case can be best put into perspective by appreciating the logical implications of the facts and the jury's decisions in this case. Notably, although Clifton testified that Mr. Brown, while showing Clifton that he was carrying a gun, forced him to have a key made to his apartment, and that Mr. Brown and Mr. Matthews used Clifton's apartment against Clifton's will to distribute PCP, there was evidence that Clifton was living beyond his means and was providing drugs to others. The jury, signaling that they discredited Clifton, acquitted Mr. Brown on the four counts related to Mr. Brown supposedly forcing Clifton to provide him with a key to the apartment. And they acquitted Mr. Brown of conspiring with Mr. Matthews to distribute the PCP in Clifton's apartment. In addition, the jury was unable to reach a verdict on the charge of carrying a firearm during a drug trafficking offense. Obviously, the government's evidence in this case was not overwhelming. All of this suggested that one or more jurors believed that the drugs and guns found in Clifton's apartment were Clifton's. That likely juror view renders the harm in informing the jury of Mr. Brown's prior conviction for unlawful possession of a firearm significant. Just as the D.C. Court of Appeals found in Eady, the disclosure satisfies the prejudice showing of the plain error review because it strains the understanding of human nature to believe that the jury would have been able to assess appellant's defense objectively after being told of the
prior conviction.
Do you
think the question is plain error or waiver with respect to the
Response on the waiver issue is that because the trial judge was made aware on a number of occasions of the issue and ruled on the issue is preserved.
Well, the defendant knowingly waived whatever right he had by absolutely insisting that the stipulation be read. We have cases that stand for the proposition that when the defense sets up the issue, puts the issue, you know, insists on the issue, et cetera, that that's waiver. Why isn't this a waiver? It seems extremely, the defense said if you don't do it, we're going to do it. So it doesn't really seem like it's a plain error question. It seems like it's a waiver question.
Well, I would have to argue that if the judge is made aware of a situation that is highly prejudicial to the defendant, he has an obligation to address that situation and not just agree to what defense counsel is doing to the detriment of his client.
Well, have you claimed that the defense counsel is ineffective? Have you made an ineffective assistance claim?
I haven't made a claim at this point, Your Honor.
Well, then maybe there's a strategy here that all the rest of us are not able to figure out, but nonetheless, there's a strategy in what the defense attorney was doing. Maybe he thought the evidence was going to come out anyway, and he was going to take the sting out of it. That would be a voluntary waiver.
Well, at the end of the trial, the evidence hadn't come out anyway when the instruction was being discussed, so I don't know what his strategy would have been at that point.
I don't know either, but so maybe I'm surprised that there not being an ineffective assistance claim, which normally there would be at this point if he thought it was ineffective.
That is always something we could
I'm not
pursue.
Suggesting that you raise one. I mean, that's not what I mean by that, but I mean in the absence of one, it's hard for us to decide that this isn't just a voluntary waiver. Go ahead, I don't mean to use up all your time.
Likewise, the conclusion that one or more jurors believe that the drugs in Clifton's apartment were Clifton's supports the likely juror finding that Mr. Brown was not possessing with the intent to distribute the PCP in Clifton's apartment. And the further conclusion that such juror convicted Mr. Brown of quid based on some other quantity and an incident of alleged, and another incident of alleged PCP distribution. This underscores that the lack of unanimity instruction on the quid count was indeed prejudicial. Finally, the failure to instruct the jury properly on the burglary count was prejudicial because that failure presents the risk that a juror convicted Mr. Brown of burglary based on the literal language of the instruction, and that the juror need only find Mr. Brown entered the apartment with the intent to store any weapons, including a legal one.
Well, it also said narcotics.
Yes, he had to find both.
And wouldn't that be understood to be illegal narcotics?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, there are a host of things that would have to be proven for it to have been illegal possession that would support a crime and his intent to commit a crime when he entered. The jury wasn't instructed that it had to be a controlled substance. The jury wasn't instructed about the quantity that had to be possessed in order to prove that he intended to commit the crime of possession of an illegal substance.
What should the instruction have said, in your view, that instruction?
In my view, the instruction should have gone through all of the elements of illegal possession and of illegal weapons possession and charge the jury with finding all of those elements as a predicate to proving he had the wrongful intent when he entered the apartment. And the judge didn't do that here.
Number two, at the time of the entry, the defendant intended to use Mr. Clifton's apartment as a place to possess and store narcotics and weapons.
Narcotics are not necessarily illegal.
That was my point. Don't you think in the context here it would be, I understand your literal point, but be understood that
well,
way?
It certainly wasn't what was required in the jury instructions, but the further fact that the amount of that had to be possessed wasn't discussed either, I think goes to the fact that that instruction was inadequate.
What amount do you think had to be?
It has to be measurable or detectable.
Nobody asked for that kind of instruction, did they?
That's correct.
The statute says you have to intend to commit any criminal offense, right?
Yes, but the case law says you have to specify which offense you're intending to commit.
Well, the judge did instruct that he had to intend to commit a crime, right?
Right, but you have to specify which crime.
And they specified narcotics and weapons. So even if you're right that sometimes narcotics and weapons aren't a crime, in this case the judge instructed that it had to be a crime, right?
Right, but he didn't give the jury all the elements of those crimes that they had to agree on unanimously.
Mm-hmm. Have you seen other cases where that's how these types of robberies were instructed, where they actually then went through every element of the crime they're in?
I don't know offhand if there are any cases in which the courts actually discuss.
I'm just asking you, have you seen model jury instructions that do it that way?
I don't know that the model jury instructions go into that aspect of it. It's the case law that says you have to established that there was a crime that the defendant was intending to commit. Anything else? Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Barbara Kate, and I represent Ira Adona. Our issue is one of sentencing. Mr. Adona pleaded guilty to one count of conspiracy, and per the plea agreement, he also pleaded guilty to a superior court offense in the superior court. Our issue is whether the sentence as imposed counted twice the conduct that was addressed in the superior court, both by a sentencing enhancement in the district court and then by the sentence in the superior court, which were imposed consecutively. We object to the sentence for, among other reasons, because the court actually had given its commitment that it would not impose the sentences consecutively and would not punish the defendant twice for the same conduct.
Where's that commitment?
There actually is both in the plea hearing, but more specifically in a status hearing that was held before the district court on July 28, 2015. There was an extensive discussion.
Do you have a JA site for the commitment? Because I saw the district court committing a lot of times to impose consecutive sentences, so.
Do I have the site to where mm-hmm. he commits not to do it? There are several, actually, but most specifically, in the July 28th hearing at page 41, at the conclusion of the entire argument, the court says, I'll go with it, don't worry. And the defense counsel says, thank you, so we're going to be a 27 for Mr. Adona. I think it's category 3, which is, I think, 87 to 104. And the court repeats, I'm sorry, 87 to 108. And the court repeats 87 to 108. But in addition to that, and I have actually put some of the citations in my opening brief where he says, you have my commitment on that. Sorry, I did quote them in my opening brief. Perhaps as I rise again for rebuttal argument, as I sit through
helpful.
The government's argument, I'll give you several. Actually, there are several citations where the court said, in fact, then goes into a bit of a monologue where he explains that he should not even tempt an appeal on this issue by sentencing consecutively. And he sort of derisively says, because some appellate guru will come forward who's not as reasonable as trial counsel and will come forward and say it was an error when trial counsel was being reasonable. And this appellate guru, which I assure you I'm not, but this appellate guru would come forward at a later time. And the court asked it. In open court, why wouldn't it be more reasonable for me to avoid this issue entirely by sentencing this concurrently and not consecutively? The discussion was had at great length. And then there's this extraordinary moment in the sentencing transcript right at the beginning where the court seems to forget that it had made all of those commitments and says, no, trial counsel would not be so unreasonable as to request such a thing. And it's an extraordinary moment because I think even the government is surprised because the court had made that very commitment. And indeed, trial counsel was not even asking that the sentence in the district court completely subsume the conduct because it had been counted as a sentencing enhancement. It was merely asking that it run concurrent that period of time which the sentencing enhancement had imposed to the sentence that the Superior Court had imposed.
You're talking about JA 481, or whatever the thing is called. It's at 481.
The commitment, you have my commitment on that?
Yes. Yeah. But I didn't understand you to be making an argument that assume for the moment that you're correct, that's what the commitment was at that point, that the judge couldn't change his mind at the time of the sentencing. I didn't notice that was your argument. Is that your argument, that the judge misled the defense and they were therefore unprepared for sentencing or something like that?
No, I think it's part of the argument because, and I actually found the case that the government submitted on Sunday quite interesting, the Rouse case. I say because I am prepared actually here to climb the hill that says this issue is not waived. And it's not waived because, as Rouse said, that a sentence is reasonable if it is imposed under fair procedures. And I will be arguing here that it's not a fair procedure for the court to make certain commitments that it would not double count conduct that he was sending the defendant across the street to plead to in Superior Court, knowing that this plea agreement talked about a sentencing range. The defendant understood that to be a number, and then the court does a workaround of that number to give it a much greater number.
The appeal waiver says you may appeal if the guideline if the sentence exceeds the guidelines range determined by the court. The guidelines range determined by the court had an upper bound of 108 months.
So
it did not exceed the guideline range determined by the court.
I would argue that to look simply at the plea agreement here for the commitment and the waiver is unfair because there is a significantly muddy record here that followed, both at the plea agreement and at the status hearing where this issue was discussed at length. And I think that the record significantly muddies the waiver with respect to his plea agreement. Also at the plea, he was assured at the very start that his plea would be reasonable, which of course it must be because that's our law, and the sentence would have no fairness or integrity if it were not reasonable. What's reasonable here, given the entire record and every promise this judge made, was that he would not be punished twice for the same conduct. And when they kept repeating 108, 108, the defendant understood that his range was 108, not 108 with a workaround that would give him double time for conduct that he went and was sentenced for across the street and then was resentenced for here because it was counted in his guideline range. I would remind the court, too, that it was not part of the charged crime that he pled guilty to. It can't be a coincidence that he pled guilty to a crime that was committed on April 30th, and the conspiracy he pled guilty to here commenced the very day after. There are two separate crimes.
And that sounds like an argument against the enhancement, which you, counsel, clearly did not make or has not been made on an appeal and agreed to in the plea agreement.
Well, because he had these commitments that one way or another it would be addressed and it wouldn't be sentenced twice. I noticed the government in its brief even backs out that time and recalculates it without the enhancement, and even there the defendant is given a sentence of 3 months less, which, if no more, he would certainly accept. But because he was assured, counsel was assured, that the court understood, and the court said, I will give it consideration, not I will consider it. There's a difference between saying I'll consider it, I'll think about it, and I will give it consideration, which means I will take that time and consider that it has been accounted for when you come back to me with the sentence that's been imposed in the superior court. That means that he will not be sentenced twice. So I think counsel was led to believe he didn't have to make that argument because it was understood that one way or another he would be only sentenced once for that conduct, not twice. And I think I've spoken over my time. So I will look for some of those other references, too, if I may rise with them in rebuttal.
Morning. May it please the court. I'll be addressing two sentencing issues on behalf of Appellant Matthews. The first issue was whether it was error to enhance the offense level based on a prior conviction, and of course the requirement is that it be a crime of violence. The underlying conviction, or the prior conviction in that case, was an attempted assault with a dangerous weapon. The second issue is, was it plain error for the court to sentence above the guidelines when the factors the court addressed as its reasons were essentially issues considered by the guidelines, and the court made no particularized findings, either orally or, more significantly, written findings to state its reasons for the departure. The first issue was reviewed de novo, and the issue is whether or not it's a prior crime of violence. The court did not say did not specify whether it was going under the first section of the statute, which talks about the elements or the categorical, or the second, which is the enumerated.
Wait, why is it de novo? Why isn't it plain error? Why is it de novo?
Because questions of this type are de novo. It's a legal question.
Was there an objection? There was an objection.
Oh, yes, there clearly was an objection. There was, and that's a good question in the sense because I think we have to look at the way this case proceeded in sentencing. The pre-sentence report originally came out and said the defendant's a base offense level 14, but may change if this D.C. case is a crime of violence. In response to that, the prosecution provided, frankly, what I think shouldn't have been provided. They provided the facts of the case, presumably a Gerstein, which established that there was a gun discharge, and then showed up at sentencing and said, of course it's a crime of violence, because there was a gun discharged, and went over, you know, the circumstances of how that gun was discharged. But what we know is, under a element approach or a categorical approach, the court is not to consider the underlying facts of the case. The court is to consider the elements of the offense at issue. And once the pre-sentence report writer changed, I can't remember if it was a man or woman, his or her version, and said it's a crime of violence based on those facts, the court had some questions. The prosecutor made those same arguments at sentencing, that it was clearly a crime of violence because a gun was discharged, and the court adopted those findings over the defense objection that you have to use a categorical approach, you had to consider the elements. And significantly here, I would suggest ADW, assault with a dangerous weapon in D.C., is not necessarily a crime of violence because there's alternative manners in which it could be committed. But more significantly and more egregiously in this case is that this was not even an assault with a dangerous weapon. This was an attempt, element of force or violence required on an attempt for a dangerous weapon. And for that reason,
doesn't the guideline application notes say that attempts still qualify?
I think there's some confusion about that because those, I believe, are attempts under the federal statute. And the federal statute is different than the D.C. attempt statute. But more significantly, I don't think that alleviates the need to examine the statute or the crime at issue. And here, I don't think there's any argument, and I don't think the government makes an argument even, that you can commit an attempted ADW without using force or violence. And it's really a legal question. We don't look at the underlying facts of the case. And I would be the first to concede, if we are to look at the underlying facts of the case or the proffer and credit that proffer, if there was arguably a crime of violence, a gun was discharged. Though even there, it went forward as a attempt, assault, intent to frighten. The intended victim was nowhere in the zone of danger and couldn't have been hit. So it was clearly preceded as an intent to frighten. But more significantly, to have an attempt, you need only the intent to commit the crime and some act reasonably calculated to bring it forward. You certainly don't need force. You certainly don't need violence. And for that reason,
because the attempt here is not just to commit assault, it's to commit assault with a deadly weapon. So to distinguish between attempted simple assault and attempted assault with a deadly weapon, what role does, to establish that type of attempt, what do you have to show about the presence or involvement of a deadly weapon?
Well,
because the elements don't quite capture that, but it's got to be different than a simple assault attempt, right?
I'm sorry?
It's got to be different than a simple assault attempt, and so.
No, it has to be an attempt. It has to be an assault in which there's a potential for deadly force, but it does not need to be a dangerous weapon in the sense of it has to be a gun or a knife. In D.C., assault with a dangerous weapon could be anything. It could be a bottle, a brick. I've seen ADW shot for.
What at the attempt stage, how is that? I'm just trying to get my head around. If you just sort of look at the list of elements, I don't know how you would distinguish a simple assault attempt from an assault with a deadly weapon attempt. And so I'm trying to figure out how that weapon factors in and whether that makes this type of attempt different than a simple assault attempt for purposes of crime of violence.
As a legal matter, because an ADW in D.C. could be committed with any object, any object that could inflict an injury, including, you know, that pitcher, I would say that distinguishes it. But more significantly is...
What do you have to show? Do you have to show that a pitcher was...
Right, and you don't have to show, for an attempt, you don't have to show that there was any force or violence used. And that's really the distinguishing part.
You have to show
part.
The presence of a deadly weapon?
No, I wouldn't think so, no.
It just says
intent along with any act reasonably calculated to further the... I'm trying to find the exact language for an attempt. The critical point, and I can't find the exact... language, I know it's in the brief of what an attempt is.
Reasonably adapted to accomplishing the crime. But if
right.
the crime involves, has to involve a weapon, does the weapon have to be?
I would think not. I don't think it has to specifically be a weapon, but more significantly, it doesn't have to have any element of force or violence. If I intend to commit an assault and move towards the location where I anticipate the victim is, that's enough for attempt. All right? There is no force involved, there's no violence involved, the victim was never a danger. But that's enough for an attempt.
How does that fit within the guideline commentary? Said crime of violence includes the offense of attempting to commit such offense. So if you have the offense, if we assume for the moment that mm-hmm. the completed offense is a crime of violence, all you have to do is attempt to commit it. We don't have to further define anything about attempt. The guideline already defines it for us.
I think there's a twofold problem with that. The first is that ADW in D.C. can occur without any violence, threats, or force.
That's a different question. That's not about whether what an attempt is. Categorically, if we decide that ADW is a crime of violence, then the guideline suggests an attempted ADW is a crime. Says that attempted ADW is also a crime of violence.
I would say you have to look at the D.C. attempt statute because that's.
I know you would say that, but the question is where you get that out of the guideline.
Because you have to look at the at what the violation is, and the violation here is not does not include any.
Well, that only
does not include
you,
any violence or.
Then you have to succeed on the principal offense claim. I don't see how you succeed by attacking the attempt part of it.
I think it could be either, in all candor. I think because ADW can occur without force or violence, and trial courts in this building have ruled that ADW does not necessarily apply in the ACCA context as a crime of violence.
Yeah. But the trial courts in the building are precedent, and we have our own precedent.
Understood. And I don't think there is any precedent here that attempted ADW is a crime of violence or can be a crime of violence under the attempt statute and under the attempted AD statute as it exists in D.C., which I think the confusion here is because the federal attempt statute is very different, and the federal attempt statute is analogous to conspiracy. It provides the same punishment for an attempt.
The guideline recognizes that we could be talking about state as well as federal crimes, right?
Right, and I agree.
So the guideline is not differentiating between federal crimes and state crimes.
No, I agree, but you have to look at the state crime, and in this instance, when you examine the state crime of ADW, and more specifically the state crime or the DC crime of attempted ADW, there is not an element of force in it, and therefore it cannot be correctly categorized as a crime of violence.
On the ADW, the government quotes the Spencer case. The Spencer case says that an element of the offense is the use of a dangerous weapon in committing the assault.
Right, and it's interesting because there is no statute for ADW in D.C., and the Spencer case applies or creates the elements. The statute in D.C. is if there is an assault, and that assault includes use of a dangerous or deadly weapon, then it becomes a felony rather than a simple assault. And I've read, and the Spencer decision does attempt to articulate elements that applies to that, but the last part is the even under the Spencer analysis, it does not require force or violence, which is you can't enhance under the guideline absent force or violence being an element of the offense.
But it requires the use of a dangerous weapon, right? That's what
which
Spencer
does.
Says. Spencer says ADW requires use of a dangerous weapon, right?
Right, but I think dangerous weapon in the context of ADW is what's the word I'm looking for? Almost amorphous, because it can be anything.
So in Redrick, we said, with respect to the Maryland Court of Appeals,
right,
operating in just exactly the same way, analyzing the common law in Maryland, that the use of a deadly or dangerous weapon constitutes a crime of violence. How do you distinguish Redrick?
Because there was no use. You do not have to have use in the context of the weapons used. In Redrick, you're right. You had to show that the weapon was used. And Redrick references Parnell, which is the Massachusetts case.
I don't understand how you're distinguishing this case from Redrick in light of what Spencer said.
Because under the attempted ADW statute.
Leave aside attempt for
okay.
a minute. Okay.
Even under the ADW, you do not have to have, in D.C., you do not have to have use of the weapon.
So you just think that the Court of Appeals of the District of Columbia is wrong with respect to Spencer? Because they
I think it's being pulled out of context there.
Well, maybe, but it is the highest court of
I'm not
Columbia,
disputing that.
And so and just as in Redrick, we read the highest court, the less than highest court in Maryland as being decisive. Why don't we have to read the highest court of D.C. as being decisive on this question?
It's an interesting academic question, but I think we're still stuck with And regardless of how it gets resolved, and I think ADW in DC does stand by it, does not require actual use of force, because it could be a threat, it could be reckless, it could be all sorts of other things. But more significantly, what pulls us out of there is that this was an attempt, and that the attempt statute clearly does not require any completed act of force or violence.
Right. Do you have an argument about adequate explanation of the above guideline sentence?
I'm sorry, you're moving.
Didn't you have another argument?
Yes, yes. Thank you. That brings us to the plain error standard on it has to do with the departure or the sentencing above the guideline range here. And this case is controlled, I would suggest, by Akigbe or Akigbe. It's virtually the exact same situation. In Akigbe, there was a doctor who engaged in some kind of healthcare fraud. The court opined how bad healthcare fraud was, and because of that, sentenced above the guidelines, but did not specifically state how, in the context, Akigbe's conduct was different than anybody else accused and convicted of the same offense. And in this case, the same error occurred in the trial court when the trial court relied on essentially guideline factors to impose a sentence above the guidelines, when both the factors the court articulated were the basis for other enhancements. In particular, the court talked about the number of guns and the level of violence, but the court had already given an enhancement based on the number of guns.
That sounds like the standard for a departure from the guidelines, not the standard for a variance under the advisory guidelines as the Supreme Court has articulated. You do not have to show what you just articulated, I don't believe, to show a variance. The whole point of the guidelines after Booker is they're advisory. Advisory means advisory. And some judges go low and some judges go high. And as long as they explain their reasons, our case law suggests that we're not supposed, and more importantly, the Supreme Court's Gall, Rita, Kimbrough case law suggests we're not supposed to second guess that as long as there's some explanation of what the judge is doing. And the judge here talks about a lot of different things, protect the community, deter others, children are involved, promote respect for the law.
But aren't those all factors contained within the guidelines, and weren't those addressed by the guidelines?
But that would mean in the variances, a judge who just thinks that the guidelines do not adequately punish certain kinds of crimes could never vary above the guidelines, and that is not the law. As the Supreme Court, the whole point of Booker is that the guidelines are advisory, and some judges are going to say, I look at that advisory, and I disagree with it, and I think a higher sentence is appropriate under these facts. And many judges, as you're well aware, will say, actually, I think a lower sentence is appropriate here. I mean, there are more downward variances than upward variances by a long shot. So I just don't know how we can second guess it as long as the judge goes through the facts of the case and gives the individualized consideration here.
And I think the answer to your question is contained within our feedback. It's a procedural error because the judge didn't do exactly what you described. The judge didn't present any reason to depart upwards why this defendant deserved an upward departure
That's a variance. Yeah.
You mean variance.
Right? Could the judge have done it here? Could the judge have done it? In other words, is this really a substantive or a procedural? So you're saying procedural is just failure to explain. So the judge could have done it.
I think it would have to be remanded for the judge to do that, yes.
What could the judge have said?
Well, if the judge has a basis to depart upwards that isn't considered by the guidelines, that isn't incorporated, then by all means, he has the discretion to do that. But to do that, under Akigbe, he needs to state with specificity, including in writing, why he's departing upwards. And that wasn't done in this case. There was exactly what was done in Akigbe. There was generic comments about guns, violence in the community, need to deter, need to punish, all of which are standard garden variety issues in sentencing.
What if the judge just disagrees with the guideline as being insufficiently severe?
The Supreme Court's already decided that's okay, so this is a trick question for you. The answer is, if the judge says, I disagree with the guidelines, the because they're not severe enough or too severe, then the judge can vary. But the judge didn't say that in this case, did he?
No, and the judge seems to have departed upward and said the guidelines weren't sufficient given the conduct, and it seems to be within the context, seems to have mirrored the actions in the Akpigbe case, which this court reversed, saying you have to state the reasons for the procedure. It's a procedural error not to state the reasons to depart upwards, and I respectfully submit that's binding on this court as well. The same error complained of in Akpigbe is present in this case, and the same result should be that the case should be remanded for the judge to make specific findings. Now, does he have discretion to do that? Of course he does.
Okay.
Yes.
On the facts of this case, the judge can impose a higher than guideline sentence. You agree?
Absolutely. He just has to have state with specificity his reasons for doing so and why, in particular, this defendant should be taken out of the guidelines.
When you say judges have discretion to do that, are you talking generically, or are you saying this guy, your client deserved that higher sentence?
Obviously, I'm not saying my client deserved a higher sentence.
Are you saying the facts of this record would support a higher sentence if the district court just said the right words, or are you saying?
Yeah.
Yes.
If the court had made the correct findings, then I'm bound.
Could a court make the correct findings on this record? That's what I'm asking you. Does this record support that higher sentence for your client?
He would have to state a reason, but yes, assuming he has a legitimate reason to go above the guidelines, then of course.
Do you think there are legitimate reasons? Does this record establish legitimate reasons? Is this just a process problem?
It is a procedural problem.
You don't think there's any substantive problem?
I would have to say what the basis was, and then I would be, you know, in a position to challenge it. But if he says this is the reason
you
why,
you can't tell from looking at this record on your own right now whether your client.
I mean, I'm not going to opine that my client is or did not have reasons to take him outside of the sentencing guidelines. That's really a decision for the judge to make.
Just to be clear, and I must say I took it the same way Judge Kavanaugh took your first answer. Were we to say there's a procedural error here and therefore it has to be remanded, is your position that the court will then give a reason that is substantively okay and procedural okay and you'll lose in any event? Or is your answer we'll have to see what reason is given and then we'll challenge it, which is the way I took your answer to Judge Millett. Which position are you taking here?
In a way, both, because I don't think they're inconsistent. I think, does the court have discretion, if the case is remanded, does the court have discretion to make findings that warrant an upward departure? Certainly.
And
have legal discretion?
Is there a basis for such a finding in this case?
That's going to be discretionary with the judge, whether he believes that there's anything that takes this individual defendant's actions.
So when
outside.
You say it's a little bit of both, maybe the answer you're giving is, well, we don't know what the judge would do if he knew that he had to give an explanation.
I don't know that the judge fully appreciated that he had to find a reason to depart outside of the reasons he articulated, which are all reasons.
He doesn't have to do that. That's not the law. The law is it's advisory.
He gives a lot of reasons.
He's lived through the whole trial. He gives a lot of reasons that he was concerned about the activity in this case, taking over apartments, what that had caused the community, young folks in the neighborhood. I don't know. I mean, this is just Booker, which go back to Booker and revisit that, which a lot of people want to do, it seems like, then we can do that. But if they're advisory, they're advisory. And you just have to explain why you think this sentence is justified. And it's not science, as you know better than most.
I'm not disagreeing that he has the discretion to depart upwards. He just has to make the findings. He has to comply with the procedural safeguards so that this court could find out and review and determine whether or not.
But the point of the procedural safeguard is so that we can determine whether it's substantively unreasonable. And
right.
If we made crystal clear in our case law that substantive reasonableness review is extraordinarily deferential because the whole point post-Booker is that as long as you're within the statutory range, it's going to be, we've said, the rare case where you can find a sentence either substantively unreasonably low or high. We've had cases with government appeals from low sentences, and we've rejected those. And we've had cases with defendant appeals from high sentences, and we've rejected those as being substantive.
I don't suggest for a moment that the judge could not articulate a basis that would warrant an upward departure. What I'm suggesting is that it's procedural error for him to have ruled the way he did and not complied with that. And for that reason, it has to be remanded. And then, you know, if there's an objection to be made, if he seeks to depart upwards, you know, on reconsideration, he has to comply with the statute. He has to give his basis. And I admit that it's deferential review.
Right, I understand. I mean, the point of your argument is that it's very hard for a district judge to vary upwards, and that makes the guideline upper bound have talismanic significance, which is what the Supreme Court exactly said created the Sixth Amendment problem that they eliminated in Booker. And of course, eight of the nine justices actually thought the guidelines range should still have significance, but the way the weird lineup worked, the one justice decided it, and the guidelines became advisory.
But I think I not necessarily agree with the first premise in your question, which is that it's incredibly hard or unreasonably hard for a judge upwards. I think there are clearly bases for a judge to depart upwards. They just have to make the findings that warrant it, and that's what wasn't done in this case. And that's why.
Are you aware of any case where we have held that a court can impose a variance, go outside the guidelines range based on acquitted conduct?
I'm certainly aware of cases where judges have considered relevant conduct that
I'm
was
asking about
acquitted.
Whether a variance outside the guidelines range of your
not outside the
rested,
well,
which you've got
yes.
here.
I've seen cases where judges have, based on relevant
court.
Conduct, considered acquitted conduct as relevant conduct, and departed significantly upwards. Yes.
I'm talking about a variance outside the guidelines range.
I'm not sure where the line gets drawn between a variance and an upward departure. I have seen it done, and I don't know if it was categorized as a variance or an upward departure based on relevant conduct, but I'm painfully aware of it having been done in some of my cases.
Can I just say, I just want to be sure I understand your argument. Your argument is based on Akibe, which was decided after Booker, after Gall, after Kimbrough. And that case held, the district court has to say why. It has to give reasons that would not apply equally to any defendant convicting of the offense and instead provide individualized reasons. And in that case, we remanded because the district court suggested that it did not suggest that it believed the guidelines range for healthcare fraud was too low even in the mine run of cases.
In the what?
In the mine run, that is in the typical case.
Right.
So that your position is that notwithstanding Booker, notwithstanding Gall, notwithstanding Kimbrough, this court has said that you can't vary upwards without giving a reason different from the mine run of cases considered by the guidelines, unless you just state, I don't think the guidelines are good enough, which is what the Supreme Court held in this year's case.
I think if the court had made
that... We may be wrong in that position, but it is the position of this court.
All right. And not to be redundant, but my position is that based on Akikbe, the court needs to particularize its findings as to why it is departing outward. Which, phrased another way, as it was phrased in Akikbe, was what takes this particular defendant out of the run-of-mill average defendant in the same situation for the same conduct. Should this person be sentenced more harshly?
Does every case for the crime of which your client was convicted involve young folks in the neighborhood?
I wouldn't know. And if the court says that's a reason to depart, I mean, as
that
a practical...
That is one of the reasons. That is one of the reasons.
I mean, I
does
think
every case involve a lot of weapons?
And there was a departure based on that. There was an enhancement based on the number of weapons. There was an enhancement based on, I forget what the other enhancement was. Oh, based on use of the weapons in connection with a felony. Exactly what the felony was never stated, but assumedly it was drugs. And interestingly, he was acquitted of all the drug conduct, much of it by the court. But nonetheless, apparently the court departed upwards. gave it an, not a departed upwards, gave it an enhancement based on the gun being used in connection with, and exactly the reasons the court stated. There was...
He refers to a lot of weapons and related acts of violence. Not every case for these crimes or these enhancements would involve that. He also refers to young folks in the neighborhood. Not every case would involve that.
Well...
Also, obviously, this case involved taking over apartments and running drug operations and terrorizing the neighborhood with taking over apartments. Not every case involves that. Terrorizing might be too strong in your characterization, but that's one characterization.
Well, interestingly, those were all allegations the government made, and several of them were rejected by the court, and the remainder were rejected by the jury.
I understand, and that's a good point on the acquitted conduct, and I've written about that, and I'm sympathetic to that, but the judge at sentencing can take into account, of course, all the relevant conduct that the judge believes occurred in justifying the sentence for the count of conviction.
And if the judge said, even though there had been an acquittal, I am going to consider these acquittals as relevant conduct, and based on that, I am going to depart upwards, that would be within his discretion. But that's not what he said. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, the things he did say are, I would argue, I mean, you ask the question, do all these cases involve neighborhoods where there are kids? Well, I don't know if that's an element of or a question of evidence in each case, but I think it's safe to assume that most drug activity occurs in communities, and in every community there's kids.
But that's not considered by the guidelines. So that is a factor that's not considered by the guidelines. There's no affects kids adjustment in the guidelines like there is in this particular guideline for guns and for other crimes associated with guns.
So I would guess, as an academic matter, if the judge wanted to make that finding and put it in writing and state, I'm departing upwards because of this, that may be within his discretion. That may be an aggravating factor. But that isn't, when we look at the sentencing thing, it's there's nothing written down. There's a couple of boxes checked off.
I thought there had been an enhancement at one point, a proposed enhancement for involvement of children that the district court rejected. Am I correct about that?
I do not recall that off the top of my head. I don't know if anybody requested that enhancement. I think there is. I know in other crimes there is an enhancement involving use of children, but I don't know if it was ever requested or examined in this case. I can't say.
Okay, I know your client obviously was upset at sentencing, and I read that, and I understand why, because the count of conviction, and then you get the high sentence. I understand that. I understand the concern from your perspective, but I'm also thinking about what our role is, so that's the nature of my questions.
I understand and I appreciate that, and I'm not saying, well, I'm being redundant. I'm not saying the court didn't have discretion to depart upwards. They just have to follow the appropriate procedure.
Well, in Settles, we said that you could consider acquitted conduct in deciding on a sentence.
It's an interesting question. Yes, obviously you can consider acquitted
conduct.
It's not
that interesting in the circuit because we've decided.
No.
It is interesting, but...
It presents in an interesting framework in this case when much of the acquitted conduct was based on a judge granting a motion for judgment of acquittal. So how do you make a finding that...
The basis for the theory about considering acquitted conduct is different standards of review, right? And for the judgment of acquittal is no reasonable jury could find beyond a reasonable doubt. And for sentencing, it's preponderance.
Right. I guess the question becomes, and it's an interesting academic question, can you find by preponderance of the evidence that the client should be held accountable, or the defendant should be held accountable for relevant conduct when you found that based on viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the government, there isn't enough there to go to the jury.
And I thought we settled that in case appropriately entitled Settles.
I'll have to go back and look at that. But I know as an academic matter, it exists.
Okay.
Anything else?
Further questions?
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, James Ewing for the United States. None of appellant's claims warrant reversal or remand from this court. I plan to cover the matters raised this morning by appellants Adana, Matthews, and Brown in that order, and I'll rest on my brief as to appellant Boston unless the court has questions on appellant Boston. Turning to appellant Adana first, appellant Adana waived his current claim as part of his plea agreement.
What about the judge's statement that you'll be able to appeal for reasonableness?
Right, Your Honor. You're speaking to Supplemental Appendix pages 56H. What the district court said was, now with regard to certain circumstances, you may even have an opportunity, the right to appeal the sentence on the grounds of reasonableness. So in context, Your Honor, that it was clear to the parties what that meant. Those certain circumstances were if the district court
clear to the parties doesn't matter. Clear to the defendant is what matters. And it's the district court's obligation to make it clear directly to the defendant. That's the whole point of this colloquy. So where can you point me in the colloquy that made it clear to the defendant that appeals could not be taken on grounds of unreasonableness more broadly?
Supplemental appendix pages 56, J, and K, Adana's own counsel, Mr. Abinanti, said, I think the district court covered us a few minutes ago with you, but he understands that he has the ability to appeal if you go above guidelines.
No, that doesn't mean that's the only time he can appeal. If he's just been told by the district court judge, I can appeal on, I think he said reasonableness, I guess it would be unreasonableness. And then counsel said, here's one instance where you get to appeal. I mean, he didn't say the only time you get to appeal, and that wouldn't be the only time he got to appeal.
I agree that there are other reasons that a sentence could be unreasonable other than if it's outside the guideline range, for example. Mm-hmm. But if you read that in context with, colloquy, supplemental appendix pages J and K, Adana agreed with his counsel's characterization of the plea.
Tell me where that is. So the part I have marked on 56J says that counsel says you would consider the advisory guidelines. The court would probably depart upward and state the reasons for that. I've explained to Mr. Adana, and I think Your Honor just went over that briefly with him earlier, that under the plea agreement he retains the right to appeal that decision.
Right.
That doesn't say, as Judge Millett said, that doesn't say only that decision.
I agree with that.
Even in the plea agreement, in the lawful sentence above the statute, he would be able to challenge, right?
Correct, Your Honor. And that's Joint Appendix page 108, which is very crystal clear, that says really the two ways that you can appeal the sentence in this case is if it's above guidelines.
Where else in the plea is it made clear to him that he's restricted in this way? In the way that you want him to be restricted, that the plea agreement
states. In the plea colloquy, it's really, it's as the court talked about in the Kaufman case. In the Kaufman case, said there was a situation where the district court said, you know, you may be able to appeal the sentence if you don't like it or something like that. And Kaufman said, you know, the prosecutor could have cleaned that up. Our submission to the court is, in this case, four pages later, the defense attorney cleaned it up. And then Adana agreed that, and that was page 56J, which is the part where Mr. Abinanti said, I believe you just covered it with him. Those are the certain circumstances that the district court was discussing. And this is in the context of this case where the district court's been saying for months he's likely going to go above guidelines. And so it was clear to all the parties. And interestingly, in Adana's reply brief, he doesn't even come back and point to this language by the district court. He just says, well, this was in essence an above guideline sentence, so therefore the clause in Joint Appendix 108 in the written plea is raised and I can appeal it because it's an above guideline sentence. He doesn't even point to this language by the district court, and our submission would be that's because everyone knew what the district court meant by that. Everyone knew that the district court was telling Adana,
well, my concern is that Rule 11 colloquies are really important for waivers of very, very important rights. And when we say everybody knew, that often means, well, the lawyers and the judge knew what was going on. Why shouldn't we still be concerned about this, given how plain the misrepresentation or inadequate characterization of the appellate waiver was during the plea colloquy?
Supplemental appendix page 56, J and K, Adana agreed personally to his defense counsel's representation of the facts of the case, of the plea agreement. So that's him affirming, hey, I understand this. I personally understand it. It's not just my defense counsel saying that this is how I'm going to be able to appeal. So that's our submission. We think in context.
So even when district courts get errors and colloquies, as long as counsel says, I agree with what my lawyer told me the agreement says, that's enough?
Well, the law, in the sense of that the lawyer said he can appeal if the district court goes above guidelines.
Where is the sentence you're talking about, the defendant agreeing that he understands?
I just have it as supplement appendix, page 56 J and K. I don't have the supplement appendix with me, but it was along the lines of, do you agree with your defense counsel's recitation of the plea agreement? And Adama said
yes. Says the essential terms of the plea agreement.
Correct. And that's what I was pointing to, Your Honor. It doesn't specifically talk about that plea waiver. If I may turn to the merits of Adonis.
Yeah,
one more question on this, which is I had this recently in another case. I mean, you all would be well advised to be on alert at these plea colloquies to make sure everything's completely clear.
Yeah.
It's just coming up too often. So I'm sure you're doing that, but I would reinforce, I said this last week too, reinforce that these kinds of things can be avoided very easily.
And I will advise the court that we have instituted Rule 11 training in our criminal division.
But more than training, I mean, there should be some, this should not happen. And I realize there are other, I mean, there are lots of people involved, but it can be easily prevented by you too. So I'm not meaning to be scolding or anything. I'm just saying we can avoid this systemically.
And that was Kaufman's teaching, is that if something muddies the water in the middle of a Rule 11 colloquy, it can be fixed.
Right, we've said
that. So we understand that. Our position here is that the defense counsel fixed it. Mm-hmm. Understand you may not kind of accept that argument, so I'd like to turn to the merits of Adonis' claim.
Can I ask you a question about the merits?
Yes.
So what do we do with 5G1.3b?
Right.
A sentence for the instant offense shall be imposed to run concurrently to the remainder of the undischarged term of imprisonment. Now, as Judge Kavanaugh points out, of course, this could be overridden by the judge's discretion, but the judge has the first step in Gall and Kimbrough is that the judge understand what the guidelines actually say, and there's no reference to this at all in the sentencing. So the judge could have said, well, I understand that I'm supposed to run it concurrently to the remainder, but this is not a kind of case where I'm going to do that for the following reasons. But the judge didn't do that. So what do we do with this?
Well, a couple of responses to that, Your Honor. First, we would say that it was waived because he didn't raise the 5G1.3 in the district court or in his opening brief. And so based on the Taylor case, it's waived because he didn't brief it. We raised it because we do believe it's germane based on the facts of this case. But this kind of goes back to this overall kind of
concept. Well, it's not waived. It's forfeited in the district court, and your argument is it's waived.
Correct.
In this court. Right.
Right. Because and just to speak to that for a moment, I do want to get to kind of the underlying idea that Adana was not on notice that these were going to be consecutive sentences, because I do think that's germane to the 5G1.3 point as well. But just as to kind of how it was raised, it's a very different thing to raise what we would characterize as kind of an equity argument in the district court and on appeal for that matter, to say, please run these sentences concurrently, you know, even though we understand you don't have to.
I don't read their argument here as an equity claim to us. They're saying legal error was committed. These things should have been run concurrently, or at least partially concurrently for the relevant time, and it was error not to have done that. There wasn't a cite to 5G1.3, but I don't think our case law requires that if they've made the claim directly to us that legal error was committed. Not, we don't have equity discretion in this area. It was legal error not to have it run concurrently. Isn't that good enough?
I guess my point, Your Honor, is that if you're before a district court judge, it's one thing to point to a specific guidelines provision and say, read this, this applies to our facts. It's another thing to say, please take this into consideration because it's fair. Those are two kind of very different things. They didn't tee up the 5G1.3.
So I want to talk about what you argued as a waiver before us. Before us,
right.
You clearly made the argument that it was legal error not to run it at least partially concurrently, correct?
I agree.
Okay.
Yes.
All right.
And I guess that brings me to kind of this underlying point that I really want to take on, that Adana did not sign up for this consecutive sentence piece. So I point you to Supplemental Appendix page 56 C and D, which was a status hearing before Adana even entered his plea in either case. And the district court said, this was in the context of the district court rejecting a number of plea agreements in this case because he thought that they were too lenient. The district court said, I'll only accept a plea with regard to Adana if Adana is sentenced first in superior court, so that I have the option, which I will exercise, to sentence him consecutively. I can't control what the superior court does, but it will be a consecutive sentence. I don't want any misunderstanding about this. So this is before Adana enters his plea in either case. He knows this is what he's signing up for, and he got a huge benefit from this plea agreement. He got 22 counts dismissed on the district court side. He got 28 months of confinement for an offense, a shooting offense, in superior court, which he could have gotten up to 30 years on. So he's going into this with his eyes open. He knows that he's signing up for consecutive sentences. In fact, Mr. Abinanti, who did not personally represent him in the superior court case, showed up at his superior court sentencing and told the superior court judge, Judge Broderick, that the district court judge was going to sentence him consecutively. And that's Joint Appendix page 337. So he's leveraging this consecutive thing in the superior court. He's saying, hey, superior court judge, the district court judge has already told me that I'm going to get a consecutive sentence. So now he's coming back and trying to say that this was improper somehow when Judge Leon did what he always said he was going to do and run the sentences consecutively. So he got a vast benefit of this bargain, which he's now kind of trying to have it both ways by saying that it should have been run concurrently. Looking at, you know, how to deal with 5G 1.3, we would say it's waived, but if you disagree with that, at most it's plain error review. And what we know about that is, on prong three of plain error review, we know that the district court would have given the same sentence because he said before Adana even entered his plea that he was going to run them consecutively. That was an essential part of the whole plea agreement. So
doesn't he have to, in light of Akibe and the other subsequent two cases, if he's going to ignore the guideline, doesn't he have to give one of two reasons, either that this is not a run-of-the-mill case, or that my policy is always to do consecutive and I don't care what the guidelines say and I just disagree with them? He has to say one of those two, right?
Your Honor, my understanding of Akibe is it goes to the guideline range. I mean, maybe this is a...
Is this about ignoring the guidelines?
Well, it's whether a... I think that's right, but this is kind of goes to really Adana's reply brief where he says, well, this is really an above guideline sentence, but he agreed to the guidelines range.
No, I don't mean that. I mean, this is the rule about consecutive and concurrent sentencing is a guideline.
Agreed.
So if you violate that, you're giving an outside the guideline sentence, which is permissible as long as you explain yourself.
Well, and I guess our position there would be the district court did explain mm-hmm. itself. I mean, 5G 1.3 wasn't raised for the
it's
district court.
It's hard to explain something that's not presented.
Right. And that's why I'm saying it's different to point to a particular guideline provision and say, you know, please, out of amount of fairness, please run these concurrently. Those are two different things. But the district court did, even all the way back to saying, hey, I'm not even going to accept this plea unless I get to go second, because I'm going to get consecutively. He's talking about the seriousness of the offenses involved. He was well aware that the Superior Court case involved a shooting. So all these things were before the district court.
It just shows that I think your argument would be tougher if this had been raised to the district court, and the district court had still not said anything about it.
Correct. I agree. Yes. And in that case, that's the reason why I sent over Rouse.
District court's got to hunt the guidelines.
Because in Rouse, the same thing happened. The defense attorney in Rouse asked for concurrent sentences but did not point to 5G 1.3. And the Fourth Circuit said, And it was briefed on appeal, unlike here. But the Fourth Circuit said, well, it's plain error review because you didn't point to the particular guideline range. I want to manage my time. If there's
before
any
before you manage your time, yes, sir. What about the written statement of reasons requirement?
Regarding, Your Honor?
The written statement of reasons requirement?
I don't have that in front of me as to Adana. I know that...
Oh, I'm sorry. It's Matthews.
Yes.
James Matthews. I'm sorry.
I can't speak... I can jump to Matthews now if the court would...
Nobody objects? Move on to Matthews.
Very well. The district court did do a written statement of reasons, just to start with Chief Judge Garland's question. It's Joint Appendix page 570 in the Matthews case, and it's...
He just checked the boxes, right?
Correct. He did. But he indicated that those, and this is cited at page 87, note 37 of our brief, and that went through the reasons why he believed that an above-guideline sentence was appropriate. I know that we started talking about the Matthews second claim was what the court was talking about before I got up here, so I'll start with that one. The district court gave ample explanation about why this was far from a typical FIP case.
Now you're talking about orally. Is that what you're
saying? Correct. Okay. Yes.
And what are the reasons that make it different than an ordinary case?
Well, different than an ordinary case include the community impact that he averred to multiple times in the, I believe we quoted most of what he said in our brief, that this had impact on children there in Woodbury Village, that the some children even potentially look up to Matthews and his drug dealing activities.
Was there evidence about children in the community in the case?
There was evidence of, well, the government decided not to call child witnesses. There were evidence of some children being present. I can't point the court to a specific.
That would be a different argument, right? That he referred to children. If there's an evidence supporting it, they can make that argument. But they didn't make that argument.
Correct. And what they're saying is that he didn't adequately explain. So the guideline range is 78 to 97 months. He gave 108 months. So he gave. I mean, this is an FIP case. He gave ample reasons why this was not just a run-of-the-mill FIP case based on the drug dealing activities of Matthews and his co-conspirators, the fact that it had a massive impact on this particular community, and I would point the court also to, I believe it's the Ransom case from 2014, that says that just because something is also mentioned in the guidelines calculation doesn't mean that it's not a legitimate reason for an upward variance. I think I understand departure versus variance, and my understanding is this was a variance. This was a variance. This was not a departure. And so he's giving his reasons for this upward variance from essentially the top of the guidelines of 97 up to 108. We think that was fully appropriate, and we don't believe remand is required in that regard.
Where did the district court say how the impact on the community of this drug dealing was different than the ordinary impact of criminal drug dealing on communities? I mean, it's bad, very bad wherever it happens, and in my sense at least, that there's children everywhere. I don't know if there was any evidence this was more children than elsewhere. So what evidence was there that this was more of an impact on the community? You mentioned that.
Well, I think that in an FIP case, which is just possession of a weapon with a prior felony, there's not necessarily any community impact at all in some cases. So that is a way that this case is different. It's a way that this case is not the mine run of FIP cases. Because the community impact of Matthews' actions, along with his co-conspirators in this case,
punishing him for all the stuff that he was acquitted of. All right. Well, that's what made him outside.
It is settled that.
Right, I'm trying to make sure there's nothing about his felon in possession sounds to me like you're not saying there's anything about his felon in possession that made him warrant a variance. It's this other conduct that it rested entirely on other conduct distinct from his felon in possession conviction.
No, I would disagree with that, Your Honor.
I'm not understanding.
Well, because, I mean, felon in possession of a firearm, there were multiple firearms involved in this case.
Which you got an enhancement for. Did the district court find that enhancement wasn't good enough?
It's just I don't know that it found it wasn't good enough, but I think that's what Ransom says. It's just because something is a two-point bump, for example, in the guidelines calculation, doesn't mean you can't also consider
it. No, but if you're going to use it for something more, then you have to explain yourself more, right? You can't just go, yep, there's two, I'd like to add another two and move on, right?
I agree with that, Your Honor, but I think that just the community impact alone takes this case out of the...
Of his felon in possession or of his other conduct?
Well, the felon in possession is the charge of conviction, so he's being sentenced on that. The community impact of his felon in possession and the way that he possessed that weapon, and multiple weapons, in fact, in the context of all this other relevant conduct. That's what takes this case out of the mine run of cases.
The relevant conduct can justify the variance.
Correct.
Right?
Yes. If I may turn to Matthew's ADW point, Matthews essentially just misreads the elements of DC ADW. Spencer teaches us that in DC, it's not assault. Matthews thinks that DC ADW can be punch somebody in the face with a gun in your pocket. That's not what DC ADW is, though. DC ADW requires use of the dangerous weapon. And so that's the part that he misses from Spencer. So that makes it on point with the Redrick case, which says, quote, certainly the additional element of use of a dangerous or deadly weapon supplies at a minimum a threat of physical force against the person of another. So that would be our submission, that he essentially just misreads the DC ADW statute altogether on that. If there are no further questions on Matthews, I would turn to Appellant Brown. Appellant Brown's jury instructions are either waived or do not constitute plain error. The UF claim is classic invited error. It's essentially the flip side of this court's case in Harrison. In Harrison, the situation was it was fugitive in a possession of a weapon because the person was a fugitive at the time they were caught with the weapon. And in Harrison, the defense counsel at trial said, please don't tell the jury about this fugitivity status. And so the district court didn't. And then on appeal, the claim was that was error because it's an element of the offense. This is the flip side of that. Because all this is the defense attorney at trial telling the judge, I affirmatively want you to tell them about this prior conviction. I'm asking you to do that.
So that's more than waiver, it's invited error.
Correct, it's invited error as Jacqueline Wheeler and we would submit Harrison as well. And now on appeal saying
that. Well, you left out the most.
Excuse me?
I would say you left out the most indicting sentence, which is if you don't do it, I'm gonna do it.
Right, I mean, if you don't do it, I'm gonna do it. So he's, and now to complain about that, we would contend is he's not allowed to do that. Turning to the PUID PCP unanimity claim, the PUID PCP count that Brown was convicted of was cabined by the indictment to January 7th to January 12th of 2013. January 12th was the day of the Lewis Clifton apartment search. So this is not like every PCP in the world that we're talking about here. This is the 9 vials that were found inside Lewis Clifton's apartment, 5 of which had at least some PCP in them. Brown's in there by himself with a key to the apartment. He's got a gun that is left on the couch when he gets up, when he's arrested by the police. So that's the PCP we're talking about here. So really all they're talking about is, does it matter? Your Honor, I see I'm over my time, may I?
You can finish this point.
Thank you. Does it matter whether it's vial 1 or vial 2 under Lewis Clifton's sink? And that just doesn't matter because that is a means of committing the quid detectable amount of PCP. That is not an element of PCP, so there was no special unanimity instruction. Your Honor, if I may just briefly address the burglary claim.
Before you, can I just ask you to go back to that statement of reasons form since we passed on to another defendant already?
Yes.
So in Akibe, we said that this checking of the boxes wasn't good enough, and in particular, we pointed out the particular boxes, which included the same boxes, some of the same boxes that were checked here to provide adequate deterrence and protect the public, provide just punishment for the offense, on the theory that the statute requires with specificity. So what do we do with that part?
Well, I guess we would contend that the statement of reasons should be read in conjunction with the articulated reasons on the record, that it doesn't have to kind of stand on its own. That's not my understanding of the Akibe rule, that it's read in conjunction with the district court's articulated statement of reasons on the record. And now we're back to Matthews, if I'm understanding.
Yes. The one I started with, we never got to it, so that's why
right.
I started to jump back.
So, I mean, we agree that it's just a box check, but we don't believe that that's dispositive here because of the reasons that the district court gave on the record.
And we've said that form, isn't that forms used for the Sentencing Commission, correct?
Correct. And I believe it's...
We've had a subsequent case explaining purpose of that.
It has to do with gathering statistics and things of that nature.
Statistical device.
Right. Why did you depart, or why did you vary? And now we're going to try to track that nationwide. That's my understanding as well.
But if that's true, if we ignore the form altogether, we still have the problem of having to have something in writing, right?
Well, I don't believe that you should. I think the form is something in writing. And I don't believe that there's a requirement that be the be-all, end-all of the reasons in other words, I don't think that the statement of reasons has to stand on its own, notwithstanding what was said in open court on the record. I think you can read them both together. And when you read them both together, it's clear that the district court adequately explain its reasons for the
vote. Isn't that the exact argument the government made in Akigbe and we rejected it, that you can read them together and that can cure the written one? And we said, no, it's not a mere formality, that in fact the written statement has to have its explanation. Didn't we say that?
I'll read you from In Re Sealed Case. However, the writing requirement is not a mere formality. The requirements that a sentencing judge provide a specific reason for a departure and that he commit that reason to writing work together to ensure a sentence is well considered.
Well, I believe in Sealed Case there wasn't one at all.
That is true.
So here we have the form. So
but that's why
are any judges right now doing more than the box checking in writing?
I don't.
Some aren't.
I believe I have seen some where where there's some language there, but I'm not sure.
Some. Right. Some are when they're varying or departing, at least.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, there's a spot there. Explain, part D, the facts justifying a sentence outside the advisory guideline system, which in this case is blank.
Yeah. I mean, we agree that was blank. We don't believe that matters in light of the on the record, in light of reading the form, which does exist, unlike Sealed Case.
Excuse me, Your Honor. This combination argument is exactly what the government made in Akigbe. I don't know how to say it. I'm sorry. Akigbe on 1087.
Your Honor,
I rejected it.
I think
we're bound by that, right?
I confess to not having Akigbe at my fingertips. I don't have any reason to doubt that. But that would be our submission in this case, is that it was just one point, if I may, going back to the Matthews variance, and before I conclude, we did provide to the sentencing court in Matthews a grand jury transcript of a child witness who did not testify at trial. So the district court did have that aspect before it when it sentenced Matthews. I know there are some aspects that we didn't discuss. We would rest on our brief as to appellant Boston. I know we didn't discuss the burglary instruction as to appellant Brown. I'm happy to answer any further questions about any aspect of the case.
Okay. Are there any further questions about any aspect of the case?
Otherwise, we would ask that you dismiss Adana's appeal and otherwise affirm the judgments of the district court.
Thank you. All of the counsel, I guess, have none of them, I expect, have any time left. Is that right? So we'll give each of you 1 minute. If you could come in the same order, if you have rebuttal. Well,
on behalf of Mr. Boston, I have nothing to reply to, so thank you.
Very briefly, on behalf of Mr. Brown, I would just point out with respect to the government's argument on the quid
possession with intent to distribute.
I'm sorry?
Quid?
Quid, yes. The government's position is because the indictment apparently specified the date of the offense, the jury must have convicted based on possession with intent to distribute the drugs in Clifton's apartment. But the fact of the matter is that the jury instructions did not include that date. And I think the gist of the government's argument may be that then Mr. Brown was convicted based on possibly an offense with which he was not charged, which is even more problematic. And on the prior UF conviction being erroneously admitted, again, we reiterate the case law that the government has relied on does not involve situations where the trial judge was specifically alerted to the problem of admitting the information that was provided to the jury. And when the trial judge is informed of that, he has an obligation to step in and correct that here.
I just wanted to let you and the government both know that the judgment in Mr. Brown's case, for purposes of count 6, refers to the March 13th indictment, which in fact is a kidnapping charge of which he was never convicted. So there's just an error in the judgment. I think it needs to refer to the March 16th, not March 13th indictment, to have the right count of conviction in there.
Thank you.
Briefly as I can. First, some housekeeping. I misspoke when I referred to the Rouse case as saying the sentence need be imposed under fair procedures. That was the Guillen, or we've disagreed as to how to pronounce it, Guillen or Guillen case that said that objection is only waived if the sentence had been imposed under fair procedures, which we argue here were not. I would also take issue with the government's argument under Rouse. The waiver in Rouse was because no objection had been made at all, not that it hadn't been made under the appropriate guideline by specific guideline paragraph. I would say, Judge Kavanaugh, to your argument that a reason can't be given unless the issue is raised, the issue is raised here, and I would just point out this judge did give a reason for giving the sentence that doubled. It was a false reason. It was an incorrect reason. His reason, which he says somewhat reflexively in most cases, was separate crime, separate time, but it ignored the fact that he had already imposed a separate time for that separate crime, and he was now doubling up on the separate time for the separate crime. So to the extent that a reason was given here for a sentence that went beyond that which the guidelines would have otherwise properly contemplated, that reason was an incorrect reason. And finally, to the government's point that the defendant was put on notice that there might be a consecutive sentence, that conversation with the judge on that day was completely immature. Premature, I should say, and given this judge somewhat immature, but premature in that the record had not yet been made. There hadn't been a trial. There hadn't been any review by the probation department. In fact, in this case, there were various enhancements and adjustments that were examined and rejected, and they're completely overtaken by the judge's later discussion of the fact that he understood there would be an appeal here if he went down the road that he was proposing to go. I promised the reference. The reference, of course, is in Volume 2, and I would encourage the court to examine from page 477 through page 481. I note there's the next page, which I hoped would have been included, and I guess because I didn't cite to the next page, I might
later moved to supplement the record, but it goes on where the judge says, I will go with it. You can argue that it's, it is 87-108 is what he says on the page that follows in that status hearing that was held for the express purpose pre-sentencing to understand how the landscape had changed with respect to a trial that now was in the record and facts that were now known and how those facts would then be addressed within the guidelines to give the defendant what he had bargained for. There was adjustments made to the amount of drugs. There was an adjustment made to the use of children. There were adjustments made based on the probation department's findings and the facts as developed at trial. And the fact that well before the plea had even been entered, this judge said, which he always says, I'm going to give you the most time I can give you. I'll be consecutive. If he had said, and I'll go outside the guidelines and I'll go above the statute, that would not necessarily have meant that this defendant understood that he had waived his right to appeal this sentence if it went beyond that which they then discussed at the colloquy and that which they then discussed at the pretty much the close of the record just prior to sentencing at that status hearing. And then at sentencing.
How should we think about the written plea agreement in this context, which refers to the within guideline sentence being waived?
Well, I take Chief Judge Garland's point that the guidelines do include also the reference to the consecutive versus concurrent. That's also a guideline. So that when the defendant and defendants, of course, don't understand the paragraph references to the guidelines, they just understand a number. There's a number at the end of all of this that they get, and this is where I am. I'm 87-108. And
But the plea agreement doesn't say you can appeal. This is a tricky part about these plea agreements. It doesn't say you can appeal if it goes outside the guidelines. It says you can appeal if it goes outside what the judge determines to be the guidelines. That is, if the judge intentionally is varying, not if the judge makes a mistake about the guidelines. Aren't I right in describing the plea agreement?
But he didn't say he was varying from the guidelines, and he didn't give any reasons. And there's also the James Brown case.
But that's the point, I think, which is he didn't go outside the guidelines. Once, as Chief Judge Garland says, he determined the range, and this sentence was within that range. Within the 87-108.
Well, for one, he did erroneously determine the range, given that he didn't take into account consecutive versus concurrent. But
I see what you're doing, and I would make that argument too. That folds into what the guidelines calculation is. You're saying the consecutive concurrent. Yeah.
Wait, I'd like to come back to your except the. The plea agreement, I think the plea agreement has to be taken together with the entirety of the record. And the plea agreement, in many ways, is, I'm not going actually to say which is a higher form or a lower form, but I think the colloquy is certainly on a level with a written plea agreement to the extent that it even develops the dialogue with the defendant of his understanding of what it is he's pleading to and what the consequences are. And so the colloquy is not for nothing. And the procedural argument, which we haven't actually addressed today, but the procedural argument too is that if he was to give a sentence that was beyond the range of 108, even if it was by workaround, he should have given a reason that was a true reason and not something based on a mistake, separate crime, separate time, when he had already imposed separate time for what was unquestionably on this record a separate crime. It wasn't within the time frame. It wasn't the same kind of drug. It wasn't the same geographic crime. It was not the same crime. So to the extent he wanted to give separate time for it, he had already done so within the context of this plea agreement.
All right, thank you. We have the argument. Mr. Zucker.
Counsel, and it was implied in your question, Judge Garland. I used my term sloppily when I said departure versus variance. This is clearly a variance, not a departure. I was focusing on the substance and
no, you were. You've been doing this a long time, and in the old days, they were departures.
Well, thank you for giving me an excuse. I appreciate that. The other part, and of course, age is always a factor, but we know that. I wanted to address, Judge Kavanaugh, you raised the point about attempt being within the application note of 4B1.2, and I'd ask the court to look at, on page 10 of our brief, footnote 6, where we cite to a Seventh Circuit case that says attempt is only enforceable in the context of interpreting the residual clause, which raises another interesting point here, because in this case, no one ever argued the residual clause, because at the time this case arose, and even at the time the appellant filed their initial brief, it was pre-Heckles. And residual, at that point, all of us were under the mistaken assumption that based on, I think it's the Johnson case that said under ACCA, the residual clause was voided for vagueness, that same interpretation would apply here. The government places great reliance on the residual clause as justifying or as a basis from which the court could have varied.
I'm sorry, what footnote of yours was that?
It's on page 10 of our initial brief, footnote 6.
Footnote 9.
And it cites to, I'm sorry?
Footnote 9 on page 10. The Seventh Circuit case, is that what you said?
No, it's on page 10 of our initial brief.
Footnote 9.
Yeah. You're right. I read it wrong. You're right. Small font. It's footnote 9. Thank you. But it cites the Rollins case from the Seventh Circuit, which says it's only applicable in the residual clause. And, of course, the residual clause didn't apply in this case. At the time, nobody argued it. And if the government intends to say that's where the judge could have granted the variance, then I would suggest this case needs to be remanded for consideration of that. Because when this case was decided, everybody believed the residual clause was already voided for vagueness because it had been done in the ACCA case. And then, of course, while this case was pending, after our initial brief was filed, I think it was the Heckles or Beckles case came out that said, no, the residual clause is not void for vagueness in the context we have here of the sentencing guidelines.
Was this called to the district judge's attention, or is this another plain error problem?
Well, it was not called to the judge's attention because at the time this case was decided, nobody thought the residual clause applied. Nobody ever argued.
It wasn't asserted by the government before the district court.
It was never asserted at the sentencing level.
No, I'm sorry. I haven't read the case, the Rollins case. I take this to mean that an attempt
only applies.
Doesn't apply if the residual clause isn't the way you're getting there.
Exactly. Exactly.
And you just told me that the residual clause was never the way.
No, nobody ever relied on the residual clause.
That would have made it very relevant whether attempt applied to a crime of violence, not as a residual clause, right?
Right. Well, attempts could not be applied to a crime of violence.
And was that said to the district court? Did somebody raise that point?
No, because it was the substantive crime of attempt that was under consideration, not whether or not the residual clause applied. At the time this case was argued, nobody argued the residual clause applied, because we were all under the impression, based on, I think it was a Johnson case, that said under ACCA, residual is void for vagueness. And so nobody argued the residual clause. Nobody considered the residual clause. The judge didn't rely on the residual clause. Now, the government, in its brief, is taking advantage, understandably, of the Heckles decision. I forget if it's Heckles or Beckles. The one that said residual clause is not void for vagueness in the context of sentencing guideline. So if this case were remanded, if they want to rely on this, I would suggest the court would have to remand this for consideration to say, is the residual clause the basis under which the court finds a crime of violence, which then raises another interesting academic point, because unless I'm mistaken, I think the residual clause has been removed from the current issue of the sentencing guidelines on 4B1.2. I'm not 100% sure on that. But the point I was trying to address was the point that you made, that attempt could not have been, the inchoate attempt footnote could not have been the basis and could not have been considered under crime of violence categorical approach. And the only other thing I wanted to address was your point, Judge Millett, about the community. There was a four-level increase because of the other criminal conduct in this case. Basically, the judge said, I increased for four levels because the felon in possession of the gun was used in the context of another felony. I don't think he made a specific finding, but implicit in his finding, I think, was that it was used in connection with drug dealing. And so to the extent danger to the community needed to be addressed, it was from that, as well as the other enhancement which is, you know, redundant with the multiple guns.
What about the children? There was no enhancement related to effect on children in the neighborhood?
No, there was not, and I don't know if one was ever requested. And I mean, could the judge sua sponte say, well, there were kids in this neighborhood, and that's why I'm going to grant the variance, you know, on remand, if that's what he wanted to, I'm sure he could. I don't know if that would, I don't know if I would oppose it, but, you know, I'm sure he, that might be the basis.
Okay.
Thank you.
Further questions? All right. Ms. Davis, Ms. Pembroke, Ms. Cate, and Mr. Zucker, all of you were appointed by the court, and we are very grateful for your assistance. Thank you.